When I was growing up, U.S. Steel, that was the ultimate company. And today you have so many closed plants. You will have protection for the first time in a long while. You're going to hire more workers, and your workers are going to be very happy. When our country can't make aluminum and steel, you almost don't have much of a country.
Trade war, trade war. Welcome to our trade war future, and also welcome to the Reason Podcast Monday edition, in which the editorial brain trust of Reason engages in a bull session about the news of the week and the day and the hour. I am Matt Welch in the moderator chair this week. And a reminder before we get started to please subscribe to us over at iTunes, rate and review us. On the line for this discussion from Washington, D.C. is Reader Reason, editor person, Catherine Mangu Ward, and managing editor of Reason.com, Peter Suderman. Holler, please.
Holler.
Hi, everyone.
Perfectly done. And from Baltimore, and we're just not going to talk about that, Nick Gillespie, editor at large of The Reason. Hi, Nick.
Bail money's coming today.
That's good news for somebody. I'm not exactly sure who.
I'll be an editor at large once again.
That's excellent. So the news of last week and this week is going to be dominated by President Donald Trump's kind of surprise announcement of that he's planning to at least impose a 25% tariff on steel and 10% on aluminum, or vice versa. I forget. Sorry for that. And we will get to Oscar discussion and some other things, our recent joint appearance at Liberty Con, which is pretty fun. But let's start with the trade wars. Catherine Mangu Ward, the president of the United States of America, said on Friday, quote, "Trade wars are good and easy to win." So just starting with you, Catherine, is he half right or is he totally right about that?
No, that's maybe in a season, in a year, in a decade of horrifying Donald Trump tweets, that one may have horrified me the most of all. Trade wars are not easy. They are not fun. They are not good. Let's talk a little bit about why we're having a trade war this week, apparently. And it seems to be based on all of the breathless insider Washington, D.C. reporting that I have consumed, basically because Donald Trump is just annoyed. That there basically was a conversation that happened in the Oval Office between the avowed economic nationalists and those who were accused of being globalists by the president. And the globalists annoyed him too much, and everything else was annoying him too much also, because the media coverage of things going on in his administration was negative. Therefore, trade war. And that's where we are. And the idea that somehow getting into a big, dumb trade war over steel and aluminum is going to distract people from the other scandals of his presidency does not strike me as awesome strategy. The stock market reacted badly last week to these rumors. It's not going to be good news for him.
Peter,
it is to follow up on what Catherine was saying, though, the idea that like Trump, if somebody had given him like some fruit gummies to like, you know, regulate his sugar, blood sugar level or something, we might not be talking about this. That is really screwy. I mean, Trump has promised trade wars.
Right. I mean,
you know, he's talked about tariffs and all of that. But, you know, one of the things that I think strikes fear into the hearts of people is the idea that Trump is erratic. And I don't mean, you know, because he can't spell or his Twitter capitalization, you know, and punctuation is screwy. But like this, that he's surrounded himself by, you know, he's not level-headed. He's not analytic. And he's now has surrounded himself with a bunch of people who are afraid to say no. You know, that's a disturbing scene. It was when it was, you know, Richard Nixon in the last days of the White House. It is now, I think, with Donald Trump.
I Peter, also want to note that we now, sorry, we now have a White House where, you know, this is not something he just woke up and thought of this week or last week. I mean, Trump has been wanting to pick this particular fight from the beginning. He ran on this, as you say. But the fact that the word globalist would be like an obvious dismissal of someone's ideas in the White House, I think, is a stage that I hadn't realized we were fully at.
The Axios reporting on this from this morning was that they were describing the meeting that Catherine was alluding to here with Gary Cohn, the free trader in the office, and Peter Navarro, the anti-free trader in the office, were banding this thing about. The president of the United States turns to Gary Cohn and says, "Wow, I didn't know you're such a globalist." That was a conversation that the president had in the White House, which is crazy.
Didn't call him a cuck, right?
That's what he meant.
A globalist cuck.
Yeah. Is there any other kind?
There's a lot of reporting out there that, the GOP is up in arms about this. You have pretty strong commentary from the likes of Lindsey Graham, Ben Sasse, other people there. But Peter Suderman, does GOP Congress, whatever amount of refuseniks over there, do they have any power in this? Can't Trump do a whole bunch of this stuff unilaterally without anyone really getting in his way?
Trump can do a lot of this stuff unilaterally, not because of the Constitution, but basically because over the years, Congress has just sort of allowed this power to devolve to the executive branch. But there's another dynamic here, not just sort of in the legalistic mechanisms of who exactly has the authority to do what, which is that Republicans in Congress have so far made it a habit to cover for and excuse the President Trump when he does dumb stuff that many of them think is quite dumb. And we all know, basically everybody who works in politics knows that lots of Republicans in Congress think Donald Trump is kind of a moron, kind of erratic, kind of dangerous, not very conservative, not somebody who can think well about policy or really anything at all. And then they go on television and are like, he's a great leader who is just serving this country. He's absolutely what we need. And no, you know, none of these investigations, none of the stuff that none of his critics are right at all, really. People just need to calm down. And so they have created a dynamic politically in which it's very difficult for them to step in and criticize the president when he does something that is really quite meaningful in terms of policy and substance.
Nick, what does it mean if we have both major parties at this moment effectively being against the sort of post-World War II global reduction in tariffs as a value that was understood, regardless of how people campaign, but sort of understood by Washington to be a great generator of both prosperity and especially peace? I mean, we forget that the Marshall Project wasn't necessarily all about sloshing a bunch of money in that direction. It was creating a free trade zone in Western Europe so they wouldn't blow each other up and they could begin rebuilding themselves. So where does that leave us when, kind of like in the same way that deficit reduction is no longer a value, that that this thing doesn't seem to have expression in the two major parties?
Well, you know, I hope, Matt, and I'm going to have to invoke our jointly written book, The Declaration of Independence. But,
bingo.
You know, I mean, and you were you were insistent on this point in the book, I think. And it's a correct one that when a viable, important, popular, demonstrably true point of view, such as one that says free trade is good for our domestic economy as well as our foreign policy, when a viewpoint like that goes unrepresented by a major party, there's disruption lurking, you know, just around the next corner. And I think we're going to see that. I hope we see that, because it is particularly stunning to see how craven in many ways the Republican majority, which is probably, you know, time limited at this point, is, you know, they're not facing up to the president. And I think they need to do that to see real change. And in a larger case, too, you know, Peter talked about how it's not really the Constitution per se that gives the president or the chief executive power in trade negotiations. It's a kind of congressional deference that has developed over the past several decades. And, you know, this is part of what people like Mike Lee were talking about, you know, in the Article One project of making Congress the first among, you know, equals in governing the country. This is also what Donald Trump talked about in pulling back the administrative state. Let's see the Republicans, and hopefully joined by Democrats, actually doing that, because it's, you know, this is nuts. It's insanity. It's going to beggar our nation, and it is going to make it easier for shooting wars. You know, first come trade wars and then come shooting wars in a lot of ways. So I think we need to really be, you know, articulating the case for free trade and the gains that have been made through that. And like you said, Matt, they're not just economic, although first and foremost, they are that.
But Republicans in Congress don't. I mean, they might talk, a few of them. I shouldn't say this is not universally true, but many Republicans in Congress do not want to lead on these issues, do not want to be the ones who have to decide about how economic policy should work, about how tariffs, about how trade should work. They want to defer to a president who they can say, well, I'm just following my guy. You know, I support the team. And so it's not just a problem of they kind of need to take a, you know, sort of like they need to claw back power that the executive branch has hoarded, although that is totally that's a real thing. The executive branches in the modern era have always kind of sought ways to increase their power and make the legal case for having more power. But in many cases, legislators have decided that that is better for their political careers and easier for them because it means that they can, in many ways, shift the blame or shift responsibility and not have to take the blame and just sort of be like, well, I'm just here to, you know, support my guys and my team. And it's a really destructive dynamic that I think Donald Trump has exploited and that the Republican Party has by just sort of allowing him to keep allowing him to work and to sort of be the way he is, both when it comes to policy, but also in terms of just his sort of extremely erratic you know, sort of chaotic management and administrative style, by allowing that to go largely, though not entirely, uncriticized, and to say that's basically okay and we don't need to worry about all of this. They have created a space for these sorts of very destructive policies to go into place. And so people who, basically what I'm saying is, all the people who said, don't worry about what Donald Trump says, just worry about the policy, you know, let's not pay too much attention to his Twitter feed. Yeah, I don't love it, you know, but whatever, like, we're getting a tax bill, they're trying to repeal Obamacare. Now, the people who weren't paying attention to that and saying that that stuff didn't matter and it was a sideshow were because we're creating a space and allowing and even encouraging Trump's worst instincts and letting us end up in a place where he can announce a trade war via a tweet, and then it kind of has to happen.
Again, I mean, there are places where that doesn't happen. So, for instance, when he tweeted out a new policy about trans people serving in the military said, "Screw you." So, you know, there still are some checks on things like that. But I agree with all of your concerns, Peter. And I think that one of the things that is interesting to kind of consider is that what we've had over the past couple of decades is the Republican Party and the Democratic Party have sorted into a conservative and a liberal party. The conservative party, and when you have that kind of rigid sort, parties need to be ideological, and they need to be ideologically consistent internally, and they also need to act on that ideology. And to the extent that the Republican Party is now turning its back on free trade, it is going to suffer, I think, losses. Because there's no reason to elect a Republican if they're against free trade, if they're against, if they're kind of squirrely on gun rights, if they're kind of shitty on like the state getting bigger and bigger and becoming more of a surveillance state. And you know, the good that can come of this is that if they take a beating in the midterms, Maybe the people with the spine and the knowledge and who are actually dedicated to the idea of limited government, particularly the ones who lead more in a libertarian direction, will have to take control of the party. But the Republican Party at this point is in ideological receivership at the very moment of its apogee in owning Congress and state legislatures. It's kind of fascinating, really.
Knitting together both of those previous points. It's as Ilya Soman pointed out over at our sister site, I don't know how to refer to it, but the Volokh Conspiracy, which we publish, that Donald Trump is changing public opinion among Republicans. Pew did a survey in December of 2016. So that was even before a lot of things have happened since, showing that for the first time, really, Republicans have flipped in their sense of hostility towards free trade. Something like 47% of Republicans polled were kind of suspicious of or of free trade, compared to something like 24% Democrats. And historically, it's really been the opposite of that. So yes, that means that these things that Trump has been saying is resonating and also kind of changing minds. I'm also reminded of when Reince Priebus, who was then the chairman of the Republican National Committee, said at the convention in 2016, the Republican National Convention, from the stage and got big applause, that it's going to be great because Donald Trump is going to punish American companies for moving overseas. And that got a big applause line. That's when you knew, like, okay, we're in a different place. So, Catherine, as part of that, it seems like we're back at basic argument time a little bit here on some of these things, which is the eternally recurring nightmare of being a libertarian in a non-libertarian world. But since the president and at least his right now kind of ascendant economic advisor, Peter Navarro, and Wilbur Ross, the commerce secretary, who was on the cable nets like waving around Campbell's soup cans the other day while his yacht was in the background.
It was pretty
great.
My
God.
looking I'd like to see Mr. the Warhol Burns. Painting of that.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that was really good.
You know, the commerce secretary is the one exception to the idea that in the future, everyone will be world famous for 15 minutes.
No matter how hard you try. Yeah.
Catherine, why are trade deficits, both individually with countries, pick one out of the hat, with, let's say, Japan or with Canada, even though we don't really have trade deficit with Canada, why are they not bad? And why is an overall trade deficit not bad, libertarian person?
So the quick version of that, of course, is that it is the simplest argument for trade overall. If people want to buy stuff, people want to sell stuff, those people can agree on a price, we're good, and nothing else matters. And that is widely considered to be an unsatisfactory account of human and international interactions by people who have other agendas, but it is nonetheless an actual true statement about the world. In particular, the idea that if other countries subsidize certain products and then the U.S. buys them at discounted rates, that somehow the U.S. is losing, I think is the most pernicious sub-idea inside of this argument. The U.S. is taking advantage of someone else's subsidy. We are taking money from the taxpayers of another country, and we can talk about the underlying issues there, but we're taking money from the taxpayers of another country and using it in a way that makes stuff for us cheaper here. On the flip side, imposing a tariff is just a embargo of ourselves. We are throwing up barriers around our own borders and saying, please don't bring your stuff here. That is not good for us. Trump said, if you don't have steel, you don't have a country. And this is something that I actually heard the very first week I came to Washington, D.C., right? I came to Washington, D.C., 2002. I went to some kind of little think tanky meeting with a bunch of conservatives. And like the very first fight I ever got in D.C. was about this question, whether steel is special and different because national security. Spoiler alert, steel is not special and different because national security.
Now, it's adamantium. Not. If you don't have adamantium, you...
And also unobtainium, and also vibranium. What's the thing? Vibranium, yeah. So all of vibranium. Those are different. But the idea that somehow if the U.S. desperately needed to make tanks and we were at war with someone somewhere, we wouldn't be able to get the steel for the tanks and therefore 25%. Tariff on steel it absolutely does not follow in 17 different directions. But I do want to just be clear that conservatives have been on the wrong side of this and Republicans in D.C. have been on the wrong side of this forever.
I want to also follow up and just say, I believe it was Frank Zappa who said the two things you need for a country are a beer and an airline. And he was wrong about those.
And both of them do require steel. So I guess aluminum for beer, which is also in trouble.
I would go even more high level on this and just sort of say that most people don't really understand gains from trade. I think that a very large portion of people just have basically a zero-sum view of the world. And even though they're sort of vaguely aware that, like, global GDP and national GDP have risen, you know, that we are just much wealthier. It's not that there's, like, more people and, like, new tech. It's that we are overall wealthier and we are on average wealthier and we have lifted all these people out of poverty. And people just sort of don't have a kind of deep, like, personal sense of that in a way. And it can be a difficult thing to explain. The best gains from trade explainer I ever encountered was actually at a class on this with about 80 people. This was in my 20s. And the person who was teaching this class handed out to every person a random either candy treat or like a little toy. And you had no choice about what you were getting. This was what you were stuck with in life. It was like a little toy soldier or it was a piece of bubble gum or something like that. And then this person, you know, the teacher said, well, raise your hand if you like what you got. And something like 20 or 30% of the people in the class raised their hand. They were happy. They got bubble gum that they liked or whatever. And then the teacher said, well, OK, now I'm going to take 5 minutes and I'm going to go away. I'm going to come back. You guys trade and see if you can get something better. And so for like 5 or 10 minutes, we all just sort of bargained with each other. And at the end of this, he then said, well, how many people like what you have now? And it was something like 70% of people, not everyone, but a lot more, because people had traded to get things that they wanted. And in some cases, you actually had people who ended up with like 3 items and people who ended up with nothing. So it wasn't that it was like a sort of perfect, you know, it wasn't in some ways, it wasn't a kind of perfect system. On the other hand, it made a lot of people better off very quickly on a very small scale that you could sort of see in real time happening to you. And I feel like far too many people do not have like that sort of very basic, very low level sense of how trade improves people's lives and improves the life, not just individually and not just for sort of certain groups, but it improves the overall welfare of the world and of humanity, as well as the individual lives of a lot of people.
The thing, the one disconnect, which is amazing to see because it's happened in the same month long span, is that Republicans and Trump administration people have been dining out on and making a campaign out of, I believe it was Nancy Pelosi's comment that the savings from the tax bill for individual taxpayers amounted to just crumbs, right? That they're getting the X amount more on their paychecks. They're like, crumbs, out of
touch. It's something like $1,000 a year, right?
Out of touch. Yeah.
700 or 1,000.
Her and her giant pearls, she doesn't even understand. But then meanwhile, washing machines are more expensive, beer is more expensive, everything's more expensive.
Cars
and stupid steel tariffs.
Yeah.
And they're out and they're all like saying, you know what, but this just is going to amount to only 0.2% of the cost of a car. So it's basically, it's crumbs. I mean, the idea that making Americans pay more money, so the savings that they want in the tax could easily be wiped out or conceivably wiped out by the extra prices that they pay. When we pay lower prices, we have more money with which we get to do more stuff. That seems like a pretty obvious thing to accept. And we'll see if that has any resonance out there. But I wonder, to Peter's point about the kind of congenital irresponsibility of Congress, it's easier for them to complain about a thing and some other forces that they can't control. I think one of the generators of the modern day kind of populist nationalist thing is not just that people feel like their lives aren't going as well as they were hoping for a variety of reasons, but that politicians have found great gain into say, you know what, our hands are tied. It's that damn WTO. You see this in European politics all the time. We don't have control over our system. It's the bureaucrats in Brussels, or it's America running the world militarily, or it's this sort of trade neoliberals, George Soros running the universe. We can't do anything. And some of these people who make those political arguments and who serve in those political posts actually know better, but have found it to be useful politics, and they get rewarded by those incentives, and we're in the world that we're in. That's my speech for the day. I'm going to pivot hard to the Oscars, because that's what people really want to talk about.
You're wearing a knee brace, Matt, make that pivot?
I'm wearing, thank you.
An intellectual knee brace for Matt Welcher, like Willis Reed. Your knees are collapsing all over the place.
That's what happens when you get old.
Yeah. Don't ever get old, Peter Suderman. What are you, 25?
Yeah, but his beard is 60. I'm so deeply middle-aged at this point.
Yeah.
That's really,
I hear all you do is talk about mortgages and stuff like
don't
that.
Even, don't even.
IUDs.
Stop it.
I don't even understand.
What happens when you combine those things?
Let's pretend
that
didn't happen.
You want a variable rate IUD?
I think the eternal sunshine of the spotless mind gives us a roadmap to how we deal with the last 35 seconds of this podcast, which is through surgery and memory removal. Let's listen to Oscar winner for Best Actress Frances McDormand give her Howard Dean-like speech last night.
If I may be so honored to have all the female nominees in every category stand with me in this room tonight. The actors, Meryl, if you do it, everybody else will, come on. The filmmakers, the producers, the directors, the writers, the cinematographer.
Okay, Nick, we didn't include it in that clip there, but at the end of the speech, very much like that party scene in The Graduate, she gives us a, all right, everyone, I got two words for you, inclusion writer. So I haven't Googled it, Nick. So is this the long-awaited reboot to Nicolas Cage's Ghost Rider franchise, or what does this mean?
It's a sequel to Easy Rider.
Now, yeah, it's inclusion. Well, you know what? If the guys in Easy Rider had a crew that was more careful, maybe they wouldn't have been killed at the end. I'm sorry, spoiler alert. So an inclusion writer is a contract or an agreement that somebody with power over production or in a production, it could be an actress, it could be an actor, it could be a writer, rarely, I guess, a director or producer, where they mandate that, you know, there's a certain type of representation or attempt at representation of gender, of sexual orientation, of race, of age, of ideology. It could be any number of things in the production, both in front of and behind the camera. And so that's what Frances McDormand is pushing. There's a woman named Stacey Smith at the Annenberg Inclusion Initiative at USC, which is a big film school, that has been pushing this idea in TED Talks and whatnot. And the idea is that, you know, a big kahuna, a big fish in a production will say, you know what? Yeah, I want to really, really want to work with you, but I want to make sure that there, you know, this movie is directed by a woman and that the crew is 50% female, for instance. I think it's an interesting idea. It certainly is a conversation starter, and it seems to me that it correlates very nicely with kind of libertarian ideas about how you might use market forces to make positive social change.
And you also might create opportunities for the kind of opposite of it, in that Hollywood has a pretty interesting approach to unions. They have a lot of unionized stuff, and they have a lot of explicitly non-unionized stuff because the price differential is pretty huge. But they're tolerant of that because they recognize that people need to get their start in the business and make their own kind of product. It's a very kind of interesting dynamic.
Well, I agree with you, although this is one of the things that I think is interesting is, like, I don't know if Frances McDormand or if the Coen brothers, whose movies she's married to, Ethan Coen, and she has appeared in a lot of their movies, including Three Billboards Outside of Hibbing or whatever.
Three Billboards was not written and directed by the Coens, though.
Oh, okay. Thank you. You know, I don't know if they are pro-union or anti-union or if they skirt that. But, Matt, you know, I think this is – we've been looking since the Weinstein revelations at how kind of reactionary and old and slow-moving Hollywood is when it comes to kind of gender issues and also a lot of race issues. In another way, they are equally stuck in the past in terms of unionization, because this was a fat, rich industry, and it still is in many ways. But, like, what happens when you have that kind of heavy union representation, because you think you can cost everything onto the consumer, it's really hard to change your business practices. And it's analogous to what happened in the in the auto industry, where, to go back to our discussion about trade, because domestic auto manufacturers up through some point in the 70s or even the 80s could just, you know, they had the political clout to keep imports out, so they didn't have much competition, and they could just raise prices on Americans and force us to buy crappier cars than, you know, at higher prices. The entertainment industry is kind of like that because of its, you know, its business structure. And that's going to have to change, I think, if you want to have a more open workplace.
Speaking of trade, it's just worth noting here that the entertainment industry, Hollywood, feature filmmaking in particular, is increasingly reliant on overseas business, in particular from Trump's favorite foreign rival, China.
Yeah. Catherine.
Well, I got to tell you, if by the way, Peter, if a trade war with China will mean that we'll see fewer movies like Matt Damon's The Wall, which was an attempt to placate a Chinese audience, you know, Godspeed, Donald Trump, President Trump.
Let's hurry that through. Catherine, as aforementioned by Nick, last night was awash in Me Too. Since you're a lady, sorry, bingo. did you watch and see, and what, do you have any sort of aesthetic, moral response to the Me Too-ness of last night? Did you high five Eva Marie Saint and Rita Moreno, who are awesome? Or because you are a robot, did you sit at home and just read old Robert Heinlein books?
I literally rewatched some Battlestar Galactica last night instead of watching the Oscars. So just living my own stereotype. Very
was
fully.
It the old Battlestar, the
no.
one with Lauren Green?
No, So I am a lady, and I assume my presence at this podcast is due to an inclusion writer that Nick Gillespie included somewhere along the line.
I always assumed that I was your inclusion writer somehow or another. Like,
yeah, the libertarian movement always needing more help to get those white dudes in. No, I mean, I actually have benefited from unofficial inclusion writers for almost my entire career, and think that it's an interesting, it is an interesting study in when people sort of vaguely feel that they should do better about representing the world that, you know, their characters inhabit realistically in terms of giving employment opportunities to people who have been historically restricted from them. The fact that this, very like the Me Too movement, is happening almost entirely in the private sector continues to be something that I'm extremely stoked about and want to, like, shout in your face at everyone who ever tried to, you know, do it using the stupid blunt instrument of the law. I think that the Weekly Standard had a piece about how the Oscars this year were just all the different movements, like, eating themselves and each other. Like, it was not just the Me Too folks. It was also several other causes sort of stacked up on people's lapels in a confusing way. I did not share the "and so this is the end of civilization" conclusion that the Weekly Standard got to. But, you know,
if you don't have the Oscars, you don't have a country.
Right. If you don't have steel and or the Oscars, you don't have a country. But I did, you know, I never watched the Oscars. I did not watch the Oscars. I did, though, enjoy that crazy Frances McDormand got up there and did that thing that that nobody ever does, which is just drop a random contractual term and then flee the stage. Like, that's right. That's the right way to do it. Make everybody do the Googling on their own, and probably it'll bring about change. The tidbit I like is that she says she recently learned about inclusion writers. Like, that was
she
the other thing.
She said, like, a week ago.
Yeah, she was like, oh, this seems like a great idea. I'll just say it, like, to America. So I like that piece of it, too.
Peter, you are the movie nerd, write about movies. So how happy are you that What's-His-Face won for Best Cinematography for Blade Runner 2049?
Oh, my goodness. I am so happy. I can't. Roger Deakins was nominated for Best Cinematography 13 times until winning on the 14th time. He is the best cinematographer of the last 30 years. Arguably, you could make a case that
he's the best. Susan Lucci of cinematographers?
He is.
Yeah, wow.
He's the Roger Deakins of my heart. I wish I wish that my eyes could, like, that, like, I'm looking forward to the future in which they, like, install Instagram in your brain and you can just have the Roger Deakins filter on everything so that every thing you see in your world will be perfectly composed in, like, a sort of study of, like, contrasting shadow and light. This guy is, like, I mean, he's just a sort of a genius that people who aren't into movies kind of don't know about.
Give us what he's done.
So the thing that you will probably recognize him most for if you're not a movie nerd is The Shawshank Redemption. That sequence in which Tim Robbins goes out and stands up and, like, looks towards the sky in the rain, you know, and the camera sort of comes up above and it's raining down on him and, like, there's, you know, mud beneath him. And that's, like, is this sort of beautiful, expressive image of a man taking freedom for himself. That's a Roger Deakins image. But you also have things like Fargo, No Country for Old Men, this year's Blade Runner 2049. He's worked with Denis Villeneuve a number of times on Prisoners and Sicario. He also worked on Sid and Nancy way back in the 1980s. So this is a guy who's been around for years. And what he really does best is he does these extremely stark, perfectly composed images that use a lot of silhouette and shadow. And so he's just maybe the greatest user of stark, almost negative space and sort of separating off parts of the image from each other. And he's really somebody who is an artisan craftsman who has elevated movies for decades now, has been kind of recognized with all of these nominations, but never actually gotten the award. And I was just so like delighted that he finally got it. He's getting on in his years, and so it was time.
Yeah, he seemed a little drugged out of his mind, to be honest with you, in his speech. The Weekly Standard piece that we reference is written by Richard Rushfeld, who's a great acidic observer of Hollywood from out in L.A., old friend of mine. One point that he made that I think is pretty interesting is that this last recent run of Best Picture winners, so it was The Shape of Water last night, it's been The Artist, it's been Argo, a lot of kind of smallish movies. He says it's more the best Oscar winners have been more like future trivia questions than the kind
that's,
of
that's presentism. That's always the case. It's mm-hmm. extremely rare yeah. when like a Hollywood classic actually wins Best Picture.
No, that's not quite right, Nick. If you go back
from
to the 1970s,
it is true.
Go from 1970 to 1982. Those are pretty big movies.
Who is What's that?
Go from around 1970, starting with I think Midnight Cowboy through The Godfathers. There was a pretty robust.
There are great movies. There are great movies that win Academy Awards, and there are a lot of great movies that don't even get nominated, much less win. That's all I'm saying. And to say like you can pick any period, and you're going to find where most of the Best Picture winners are either not that great or they're forgettable.
What I'm saying is that. We have moved into a period where the Best Picture winners are not well seen. And so there was a graphic going around Twitter that is accurate, which is that between 1990 and 2004, 12 of the 15 Best Picture winners grossed more than $200 million. They were solid, if not really strong, domestic hits. Since then, since starting in 2005, zero of the 13 Best Picture winners have hit the $200 million mark domestically. And so we've moved into a world in which the Academy tends to recognize these smaller, artsier films in many cases that I quite like, but that are not well seen, rather than these kind of these big tent poles that people can rally around. And in part, that's because all of the tent poles now are basically superhero films, Disney remakes, stuff like that. And I like a lot of those movies, but we've moved away from a world in which some of those really big movies are also great films that are then recognized as great. That was why I was rooting for Dunkirk to win Best Picture, because it was a popular film, but also a big budget movie that really almost all of the other Best Picture nominees, I saw all of them except for Darkest Hour, and almost all of them you can imagine existing on Netflix or on HBO or as miniseries. So, you know, even something like Shape of Water, which is this really kind of beautifully directed, you can imagine a version of that movie looking almost as good existing as like a 6-episode thing that airs on HBO.
Well,
you can't imagine Dunkirk existing anywhere except on a big screen in the feature film format.
No,
and that's what Christopher Nolan does.
You're wrong,
and that
Peter.
Should be
like
rewarded.
People will watch that. People will watch that on, you know, on HBO. I mean, it's like Band of Brothers. I agree. It's like Dunkirk was a great experience in the theater, and particularly if you went to a high quality theater with a good sound system. But the fact of the matter is that people don't care as much as movie buffs do about the, you know, where they see a movie. They care, you know, production
values
are important.
I'm not saying that people won't can't or won't appreciate the movie on a small screen. I'm saying that that is the kind of movie that requires the sort of the infrastructure of Hollywood mega spectacle. A 70 millimeter IMAX production that costs $1 zillion is the product of basically one guy's kind of like insane fever dream where they, you know, rent battleships and crash them, you know, for
Dunkirk
the movie, right?
I mean, will like, also be, and it is an answer to a future trivia question because I guarantee you, like, nobody is watching. No, I'm just saying, like, well, you know, Matt, this is like, World Series champions and things like that. No, you know, like, yeah, you care for a moment and then it kind of fades away.
There's something it's, that nobody it, cares know, about sports.
Yeah, no. But I'm just saying that. And in fact, you know, this past year, this is an interesting thing. In North America, Canada and the U.S., rather, Hollywood had its worst year since the early 90s. It sold fewer tickets. Like, so it's not about how much tickets cost or how much revenue, but it actually fewer people went to see movies in the past year in the U.S. and Canada since it's lower than like 1993. And that's something that Hollywood should be thinking about because it's, you know, if the theater experience matters, you know, they've got to do something. And obviously they're working towards this by upgrading movie theaters and blowing out movies into IMAX 3D spectacles and things like that, or even 4D. You know, but that's the real problem, not the fact that, you know, The Shape of Water, which again is just an update of a remake of The Incredible Mr. Limpet with Don Knotts and better prosthetics. you know, that's the biggest problem.
My favorite moment of the Oscars last night, which I thought was fine, you know, whatever. But there was this, when the worlds collided. So Jimmy Kimmel leads a group of stars into the theater next door. The Man's Chinese. I think has a different name now.
Although it still is Chinese.
Still Chinese.
That's the one thing that hasn't changed.
They don't call it the Red Chinese, which by God, you always should. But they go in there next door to watch people who are sadly for them watching the new Wrinkle of Time. A Wrinkle in Time film. And it was this great thing where, first of all, as Jimmy Kimmel pointed out, the room smelled like pot. Everyone was just like stone cold vaping marijuana in the movie theater, which I totally appreciate. Second of all, he had a train of people in there, including the woman whose name I can't pronounce, Lupita Nyong'o.
Gal Gadot
was in there.
There's a lot of women whose names we can't pronounce happening in Hollywood right now because inclusion writers, probably.
Yes, definitely inclusion writers. But you could see that everyone went absolutely nuts for, and like we're standing up and pointing, probably because they were stoned, at Mark Hamill. It's just like, dude, Mark Hamill! And they're coming in.
Yeah, because he's the guy who voiced the Joker.
God, anyways,
man, Peter.
But silence. Like, it was condemnatory silence fills
Peter.
The podcast.
There's always this weird gap in between the way Hollywood talks about itself, particularly on its prom night, and then the way that it is their products are received out there in the real world. And even though, you know, you can't really argue that Hollywood Boulevard is the realest world out there, but you know, Jimmy Kimmel put his mic in the face of a guy who's going to be the to announce the next category, and he was just this wild-eyed dude with a beard. He might have been stoned himself, and it was just kind of an interesting snapshot of those worlds uncomfortably colliding, and also what they really care about more than anything else is Star Wars. And I'm going to pivot the hell out of the Oscars, break my other knee, and go into something that is not getting nearly as much attention as either Trade Wars or whatever flaccid Mike Pence jokes that Jimmy Kimmel told last night. I don't the Mike Pence joke always has to come. I don't get it. But anyways, last week, even though few people really paid attention to it, the House of Representatives passed a bill called Allow States and Victims to Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act. I don't know what language that is in, and I don't even understand why that ends up with the acronym of FOSTA, but it does. This is FOSTA, and I'm not talking about George. Cue Nick to giggle knowingly here.
No. You're going back to the Chinese thing, aren't you?
what this does is updates the Communications Decency Act of 1996 in such – what?
Are we booing the updating or the act?
Yes.
Oh, he's booing the act.
Yeah, the act.
in such a way that if anyone uses a website or a web service or an app, and that ends up becoming a commercial sex transaction. So I use Craigslist to have commercial sex with Nick Gillespie. Then Craigslist or whoever.
You know, Matt, I'm sorry, I need to correct you. It's artisanal sex.
It's so cute. In Baltimore. Then they become criminally liable and also civilly liable. It's just a thing that is so... this bill was so bad that it was opposed by the Department of Justice as being kind of, you know, sort of unconstitutional and whatnot. It passed in the House by a vote of 388-25. Catherine, as the person who has edited and shepherded a lot of work by our colleague Elizabeth Nolan Brown, including about all of this, what kind of terror should people be feeling anytime Congress gets around something in the name of sex trafficking?
Yeah, I mean, super robust bipartisan support for a bill with the word sex trafficking somewhere in the name or summary is pretty much always going to be bad news. And that is absolutely true in this case. As Liz noted in her post about this for us, the response from sex workers, sex trafficking survivors, free speech advocates, human rights activists, tech companies, due process proponents, and many others was less than positive. That's pretty much our coalition right there. And the fact is that for a very, very long time, lawmakers have been trying to figure out how to take well-organized entities with lots of money and make sex trafficking their fault. And this is their best bet on that. It's not a good idea, A, because sex trafficking is not their fault. Like, on a deep, fundamental moral level, the idea that you providing a platform which millions or even billions of people use for innocent enjoyment and to facilitate legitimate commercial enterprises and all kinds of other great stuff, that a few people figure out how to use it for something bad is not an indictment of that thing. And it shouldn't be. And it certainly shouldn't be used to bring that thing down. In this case, that thing is the place where I live virtually all of my life. Instagram, Facebook, other social media, Twitter. Those companies should not be liable for what is being labeled sex trafficking here, but which is in many, many, many cases actually just commercial sex trade.
Nick, you've been writing about the Communications Decency Act for a quarter freaking century here. Yeah. In addition to saying whatever you were about to say, can you give us a little bit of your sense of the perennial drive from Washington to restrict internet speech ultimately in this exact name, whether it's sex trafficking or protecting our vulnerable people's eyeballs from upsetting images?
You know, the one thing that came out of the Communications Decency Act, which, you know, was mostly struck down by the Supreme Court in the mid-90s and was huge that it was struck down, because it would have effectively, the Communications Decency Act would have effectively regulated the internet like a broadcast network. It would have given the government vast control to go in. And back then, it was Janet Reno pushing it in particular. It was always done in the name of the children and exploitation of children, that type of stuff. We needed to keep online pornography away from kids. We needed to keep frank discussions of sexuality, you know, and other, you know, objectionable things from little eyes that could get online and see. This is a perennial attempt by certain people in power to whittle down the thing that makes the internet so freaking great, which is that wide open nature of things. And at the root of that is part of something that is it can be challenged here, which is the Section 30 of the final Communications Decency Act, which created a safe harbor for websites like the ones you were talking about, whether it's Craigslist, whether it's Reason. And Reason, as a publisher of a website, we are not responsible for comments in our, you know, that users add to things, in the same way that Craigslist is not responsible for, you know, somebody acting badly or committing fraud using their site. You know, this is huge. And it was a reversal of traditional responsibilities for publishers, where publishers in the past could be held much more liable for that kind of stuff in meat space. I think we really need to, you know, push back on any incursion on that, because That is the thing that makes the internet, and it has so vastly increased the ability of people to express themselves and to articulate what's going on in the world as they see it. And, you know, we really, really need to be draw a very bright line against this type of law.
Hillary the Electronic Clinton. Frontier, the Electronic Frontier Foundation people just keep saying over and over this like very simple idea, which I think is right, which is that Section 230 isn't broken. That's, I mean, Section 230 is the section that protects this type of communication, and it's not broken. It works. It, in fact, arguably is the thing that enabled the internet to become what it is today, as Nick has said. It is not like a loophole. It's one of our most important laws underpinning the function of the internet. Now, the fact that it happened sort of accidentally is true. It's not 100% clear that the way that law was written was with the vision of the internet as it functions today in mind. But still, the idea that somehow there's no way for us to catch actual human traffickers unless we make it so that, like, you know, Maggie McNeil can't use Instagram is utterly absurd.
Peter, I don't mean to put you on the spot since this is Liz's beat and not yours, but just on the odd chance that your massive brain and Dan Fouts' beard happens to know the answer to the question. This is now in the Senate. Do you have a sense of the likelihood that it's going to be taken up or passed at all in the Senate?
The expectation is that Trump's going to sign it and that Ivanka is going to be, you know, sort of a booster here. This is a problem that goes up to the top. This is a sort of a cause that has been taken up by influential people in the Trump administration. And Trump is happy enough to put his name on this sort of thing. I mean, I think, you know, sort of in a very general sense, there's sort of two issues here. One is that the kind of zeal to go after sex trafficking and human slavery has really people don't understand the what's going on there, and people don't. And when I say people, I mean lawmakers. Lawmakers don't understand what's going on with sex trafficking and what's really happening and what's not. And Elizabeth Nolan Brown has done really great work at sort of showing that they just have a fundamental misunderstanding of what is and isn't happening across the globe when it comes to sex trafficking. The other part is they don't understand technology and they don't understand the internet. And I go back to this constantly on this podcast, but our lawmakers are just technologically inept in a really, really serious and worrying way. And so pretty much whenever there is a kind of large scale, you know, sort of mass movement to quickly pass legislation that deals with technology, it is almost always bad because the old people who are making our laws are just completely clueless about this stuff and in many cases uneducable.
And this is actually in contrast to people in Congress do, I think, understand the other thing you were saying earlier that people have a hard time understanding, which is that trade is not zero sum, right? Like people in Congress, by and large, grasp this basic idea of economics and choose to ignore it, minimize it, think that there are caveats on it for various practical reasons. That is different than the fundamental lack of understanding about the technological underpinnings of our most important.
I'd also innovation. Just add that there's a possibility that this bill backfires and that basically by what it ends up doing is that it moves to the extent that, like, you know, sort of human slavery and sex trafficking that is, you know, sort of that is, you know, sort of the kind of the kind that people are worried about most is happening on sites like Backpage. That it moves all of that off of Backpage and into places that are harder to see and monitor, and so therefore makes it even more difficult for authorities to actually catch people who are doing bad stuff.
But that kind of backfire, lawmakers are amazing at ignoring, right? Like, if this law backfires in that way, which I believe there's an extremely strong chance that it will, if it's actually enforced as it's intended to be enforced, which I think there's another wiggle room there, which is that the people charged with implementing this could choose to enforce it only selectively, which would be bad, but not as bad as if they enforced it across the board. To sort of say, like, well, now there's all these, you know, people dying in the streets because they had to do their black market transaction in a more dangerous and higher risk way. People are going to say, look, that's evidence that this problem is even worse than we thought.
Guess
need more
we better
laws.
Regulate that, too.
I think the likeliest scenario, should this thing be passed and then signed into law, is that it would be immediately challenged. That challenge would get to the Supreme Court. And the current composition of the Supreme Court is about as strongly pro-free speech as any we've seen in a really long time. I think chunks of it would get, I mean, we're much more free speech than they were back in the mid-90s when the Communications Decency Act was passed, and a bunch of other crappy bills besides to regulate, you know, video game content and a bunch of other stuff. And again, Hillary Clinton's fingerprints were all over every single one of those efforts. Might be the first one that she hasn't been intimately involved with in there. So I think the likelihood is that the Supreme Court would knock it down. But just looping that back to the previous conversation with Suderman about kind of a congressional abdication, there's just this idea, well, let's just have, we know they'll take care of it, so we don't have to. I mean, to the extent of which there's people in Congress who describe themselves as constitutional conservatives, if any of those bastards voted for this, and they did, many of them obviously did and will in the Senate as well, that's just a joke. And a lot of those people are the same people who might have been, you know, complaining about snowflakes and about how people on the right are getting their free speech trampled down on college campuses and elsewhere. This is one of the worst kind of legal attempts or congressional attempts to restrict the amount of free speech out there. I think it's blatantly unconstitutional, and you shouldn't let the Supreme Court do your business for you. It's a gross bit of dereliction in duty. Nick, were you clearing your throat?
I was going to say, there's a rising sense that Trump is, you know, whether you like him or dislike him or in part or in whole. And I think we've talked about ways in which he's actually pushed good policies. But in a broader sense, there's a rising recognition that he is forcing a clarifying moment, both to the Republican Party, to Congress as an institution, to the presidency. And, he's really demystifying the presidency. He's having that effect on the larger government. We can use this as a way to go back to arguments that are important and that are foundational to libertarian values of, free minds, free markets, autonomy, pluralism, et cetera. And I think, I'm not saying it's a good thing, and I agree with you completely. You should never bank on the Supreme Court to do your bidding, because that's a failure of the legislative and democratic process. But, these will not all have bad outcomes, because it will force people, I think, to recognize what they value most, and then how do you get there quickly, as opposed to these roundabout stupid ways that we're forced to go through now.
So speaking of libertarian arguments, all of us on this here podcast spent some of Friday and especially Saturday over at LibertyCon, which is what the rebranded conference for the International Students for Liberty, which is a youth's libertarian organization that has chapters and outlets all over the damn place. Very fun. We've been taking part for a while. This time around, we had a little reason day. Suderman made cocktails, obviously, made it part of some kind of demonstration. Nick and Catherine and I signed Reason branded rolling papers. Catherine talked a lot about like guns, sex and weed. So were we all just living down to stereotypes, libertarian stereotypes? And or just quickly before we are getting out of here, highlights from any of you or overall senses of where the kids are these days out there? And I'll just throw it to Catherine to start with.
Yeah, I definitely leaned maybe a little too hard on the libertarian stereotypes. My panel, it was me. It was Mary Catherine Hamm of CNN and The Federalist. It was supposed to be Kat Timpf of Fox. Unfortunately, her train got delayed. And former Reason intern Liz Wolf. We sort of rallied up right before the panel. Had done some planning, but not totally formalized it. Mary Catherine walked in and I was like, okay, hi, we're all here. So there are three of us. That means Mary Catherine, you take guns. Liz, you take sex workers. I'll take drugs. Ready? Go. And that's how we planned our panel.
It was great. I watched it.
And it worked pretty well. That is to say, I did have a slight feeling of like, should we have done a little more tariffs are bad? Maybe. Yeah. I had a little bit of guilt for leaning into the sexy libertarian topics afterward, but
leave any time for the robots was really what
we
was
talked
missing.
About sex robots. We just didn't talk about the other robots enough.
Peter, what'd you think about the kids nowadays?
The kids are great. They're all right. They came up and asked me about how to improve their drinking afterwards. And I told them that if they're under 21, I don't support that. But the minute they turn 21, here's a couple of options.
You did not totally tell them
did.
That.
Totally did.
They should drink before they're 21.
Hmm. Nick, yes, you've been going. I think have you gone to all of them since they started?
You
or
know,
close
if,
to it?
If not all of them, pretty close. Yeah.
How have you seen it evolve over the years? To whatever extent?
Oh, you know, I think Students for Liberty is a fantastic organization, and it went from being small to being much bigger, and also really international in a way that is, I think, profoundly meaningful and moving. I felt bad at when they give out awards for the best kind of activist, student activist of the year, as well as for the best student group. There were people in countries, you know, ranging from Brazil to Venezuela to the United States to Georgia in the former Soviet Union, to Chile, like all over the place, to Burundi. The guy who won the Student of the Year was in Burundi, and he could not come and pick up his award because both the Burundi government but the American government, the U.S. government, wouldn't, you know, give him a visa, which is stunning. But it speaks to, you know, the thirst for, you know, for like individual liberty, you know, around the globe. And to put it in a Students for Liberty context, I've seen that group grow in the past 11 years from a relatively small group to this international force that is, it's incredibly inspiring, I think.
Yeah, that moment during the awards dinner when they were like, one of the best student groups was the Venezuelan group, where their members visited one of their members who was in prison for a month every day. And you're like, what are we even doing around
what
here?
What are we even complaining about?
And the answer, of course, is lots of things that legit need to be complained about. But still, kudos to Venezuelan Students for Liberty.
All right. Lightning round here. You can only have one answer, Nick. But before we bounce out of the recent podcast, and again, go out and subscribe to us on iTunes and leave and rate and review us and all that kind of stuff. What are you people reading, watching, eating, grokking, or whatever? Catherine, you start.
I am listening to LeVar Burton Reads because I am a child of Reading Rainbow, and there is now a show where he reads grown-up short stories. I love short stories. I love LeVar Burton. He can read them to me in my ears. The internet is amazing.
Hey, Matt, does LeVar Burton read the version of the Ron LaFleur story, do you think?
Oh, my God, that would be great. Oh, my God, that would be great.
I just want a podcast where LeVar Burton does nothing but say, like, scientific terms from Star Trek The Next Generation. Like, where he's just,
I'm
like...
I'm sure there's a supercut of that on YouTube.
Just, like, tachyon emitter fields over and over again.
That's what it sounds like in your head all the time, isn't it?
Suderman, what are you consuming?
I've been watching Counterpart on Stars. It's a very good show about a kind of, it's sort of a sci-fi riff on the Cold War. Basically, the idea is that sometime in the late 1980s, right before the Cold War ended in Germany, they discovered a portal to another world that is just like ours, except the timeline started to diverge right before the end of the Cold War. And so now there is a sort of continuing Cold War between these two sort of shadowy sides, both of which want things from the other and have this sort of like tense detente. And J.K. Simmons, of course, is at the center of this, giving two performances. One is the sort of very badass version of himself who rose up through the spy agency, and the other is the kind of the lowly, decent family man who stayed at the bottom of the spy agency that manages the back and forth between these two different timelines. It's a really good, smart show that just does kind of plays with some Cold War ideas in some really interesting ways.
I am reading The Sovereign Individual, which is subtitled Mastering the Transition to the Information Age. It was originally published in 1999 by James Dale Davidson and Lord William Rees-Mogg. And it is Jim Epstein, our colleague at Reason TV, had been talking it up, as well as a recent interview subject, Balaji Suryanivasan, a cryptocurrency VC out in Silicon Valley, also talks a lot about it. It's a fascinating book that that predicts a lot of what we're going in, and particularly some of the stuff that Catherine has identified as in the same way that Neil Stevenson's Snow Crash is a fascinatingly forward, you know, good look at what happened, written a decade or two before it happened. The Sovereign Individual is very much like that. I highly recommend it.
And I will close out by saying that we've recently acquired the Alexa Amazon robot. So I use it to surf for music. And the band that I've been asking Alexa to shuffle recently is the great late 60s, early 70s Dutch chick singer band called Shocking Blue, whose one song that you'll probably be familiar with is the Venus. You know, she's got it, except in this ridiculous accent. And wonderful videos if you go on YouTube and watch it. But it's a really good kind of post Jefferson Airplane crazy Euro trash band, and I recommend it to everybody. And that's all the recommendations we have time for here on the Reason Monday podcast. Thank you for listening. Go back and subscribe to us, and goodbye.